You're listening to The Diplomat's podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm Ankit Panda, an editor at The Diplomat, and I'm joined today by Katie Putz, who is our Central Asia editor. Thanks a lot for joining me, Katie.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And the reason we have Katie on today is not because we're going to discuss all these hot topics in the news, including the Greek debt crisis, China's stock market, or the Iran deal. No, we're going to talk about Central Asia, which is an often under-discussed region, but we're very excited to have Katie on this podcast. You may have noticed recently on The Diplomat, we've had a lot more content on Central Asia, and a lot of that is due to us bringing Katie on. So Katie, thanks again for all you do. We're specifically going to frame this conversation around three different topics. So we're actually going to first talk about Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's tour of Central Asia. He's currently still on an eight-day trip at the time of the recording of this podcast. His trip began on July 6th and will end on July 13th. He's already visited Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, and he was in Ufa, Russia for the past few days, where he was attending the BRICS and SCO summits, and we'll talk a bit about those as well. And just 2 hours before we began recording this podcast, Modi touched down in Turkmenistan. And after Turkmenistan, he will visit Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, completing a Central Asia tour before heading back to India. After we discuss Modi's trip, we'll talk a bit about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and its role in the Asian geopolitical landscape, how it fits into China's leadership as an international power. And we'll talk a bit about India and Pakistan's accession into the SCO and what that means for the organization, whether that'll make it more or less effective. And finally, we'll end with a few brief thoughts on a meeting that happened at the SCO summit between Modi and his Pakistani counterpart, Nawaz Sharif. And we'll talk a bit about what that means for India-Pakistan relations. So, Katie, why don't you kick us off a bit by telling us about what Modi accomplished in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan and the significance of those two countries for India's foreign policy, and also how these Central Asian states generally view India?
I think one of the sort of most important things to draw out of Modi's trip to Central Asia, and it's not done yet, but these will largely hold true for the rest of the trip, is that it very much focuses the conversation on a historical aspect, and I can get into that, and then also economics, energy, and security. And so India in Central Asia is less of a big player than Russia or China. But it certainly has a role. And I think it was 2012, the Indian government engaged in a what they called Connect Central Asia policy. And it kind of lay a little bit dormant for a couple of years. And this is that coming back to life. So looking at renewed investment. So, for example, in Kazakhstan, India and the Kazakhstan's nuclear agency, essentially, they signed a contract for, I think it was 5,000 metric tons of uranium over the next 4 or 5 years. And that had basically doubled the previous contract to India. Nuclear power is something that I think the Modi government is looking at investing more deeply in, given the energy deficit you have in South Asia. It's definitely something they're interested in developing, and to do that, they're going to need uranium, and Kazakhstan has the largest supply. And
right. So that I should also just add the, you know, just for context, that Modi's diplomacy with Canada and Australia, two other major suppliers of uranium, was very much focused around that resource. So he's really been going after uranium deals. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, no, that's largely when you look at Central Asia, a lot of its relations with outside powers do follow this energy trend. And I think as far as they're concerned, any investment they can get is great. It's not the world's most economically dynamic region. And certainly given the trouble that Russia's economy has experienced, you see Central Asian states looking for basically where they can get funding from and where they can get investment. And so I think Modi also inaugurated like a supercomputer in Kazakhstan. That was kind of interesting because the tweet said like super like six times.
yeah.
Very interesting, at least in my opinion. And then, you know, there's also this focus on security. And so one of the things Central Asian states like to, I would say, hype a little bit more than the actual threat is Islamic terrorism. ISIS has been a very big topic in recent months. And so I think India shares some of those same concerns, and it's very nice to be able to say we're going to have more defense cooperation between us
Right.
How that actually plays out, is not clear. And, you know, I've done a lot of talking about what's been accomplished in Kazakhstan. That's because we know what's been accomplished in Kazakhstan to a degree. I think there were two or three MOUs signed in Uzbekistan, but the details are not necessarily public. And so that kind of hampers trying to figure out what has been accomplished aside from a visit.
Right. I wonder how differently Modi's trip would have gone had, you know, oil prices not tanked the way they did. Since, you know, like you said, the two big factors that have kind of changed the economic game for Central Asia, I feel, has been, you know, the collapse of the ruble and obviously the collapse of the oil prices. You know, both of that combined have kind of left Central Asian states in a very different position from an energy perspective. I mean, obviously the fall in oil prices was a huge windfall for the Modi government in its first year in office. And, it helped how the Indian government budgeted for energy subsidies and stuff like that. But I wonder, what the effect would have been like if things had been different.
I think it would have largely been the same. Regardless, Central Asia was going to be looking for another buyer anyway. I think something to look forward to that we don't necessarily know the answers to because he just arrived in Turkmenistan is if there's any mention made of the Tapi pipeline, which feels like this thing that's always been talked about, but would link Turkmenistan to India via a pipeline that goes through Afghanistan and Pakistan. So just those four in one acronym, I think, brings up an awful lot of concern about whether it's actually going to ever happen. And so I know India certainly hopes it does, and Turkmenistan, which is this week very interestingly accused the Russians of not paying for any gas this year.
Right.
Though we don't know the amounts. Turkmenistan has been exporting less to Russia because Russia has basically said, we want less from you. And that has more to do with Russia's internal issues. But that has left Turkmenistan very much reliant on China as essentially its only major buyer. And so expanding that to India is important, definitely for the Turkmen government.
Yeah, my hunch is that we'll hear something about Tapi out of this visit, particularly given, current dynamics between Afghanistan and Pakistan. It makes it more likely as a project, but I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, you'll be on top of that next week. So if listeners are interested in the Tapi pipeline, make sure to check back at our Crosswords Asia blog, where Katie has the latest on Central Asia every week. So do you want to talk a bit about this history thing? History is, at least in Indian diplomacy, it seems like something that Modi and his predecessors have always loved to bring up as a diplomatic sort of bridge. When Modi travels to Japan, he will talk about Buddhism and India's, historic connections. He did that in China. He did that in Mongolia recently. He always does that in Southeast Asia as well, where there's a large, Indian community. And it just seems like history is always a major framing tool for Indian diplomacy. And the Central Asian angle is very interesting, especially with Uzbekistan. And I'll actually let you fill us in on the details on that. Can you tell us a bit about the history there?
Yeah, so in my mind, I'm sure there were scheduling reasons and all of that. But one of the reasons that Modi started his trip in Uzbekistan is that the Fergana Valley, which is split between three of the Central Asian states, is the birthplace of Babur, who founded the Mughal Empire, which is this what ruled India before the British Raj arrived. And so you have this historical connection. And the interesting thing about Babur is he was born in the Uzbek city of Andijan, and that was his first kingdom, essentially, was in the Fergana Valley. And he lost that to relatives, essentially, and made his way through Afghanistan and into India, where he made his name and made his kingdom. And so I think that historical tie is how they framed a lot of this. And the interesting thing to me in that Modi's statements in Uzbekistan and in Kazakhstan mention this historical relationship and then go on to essentially say, we have so much more potential for economic interaction and cultural interaction that we're not actually at yet. So I found that interesting. It was sort of, there's all of this history, but we're not quite using it. And so there's this space to grow. And so the details of what came out of the Uzbekistan visit had to do with culture and tourism.
Yeah. It's also interesting that, you know, Modi is the Indian prime minister making these statements, since, you know, he is a Hindu nationalist, and there are elements within India's Hindu nationalist political circles who you know, tend to see the Mughal Empire and India's sort of legacy as being conquered by these foreign Muslim invaders as something that derailed India's longer-term development. I mean, obviously, you have the British Empire there, which is another variable. But I think it's a bit interesting that Modi is the one to bring it up. I mean, I'm not sure. I really doubt that he personally holds these beliefs about history. But, you know, just from... from the perspective of Indian politics.
In a way, it's a way to explain why Modi's visiting all of Central Asia. Economics and energy and security are not as, I guess, not as sexy topics, not as interesting sometimes as sort of a weird historical link. And so I think that's what they played up. But there's certainly an interesting dynamic to be said between Central Asia's Muslim heritage and the role of other religions in the region. And, you know, we call the blog Crossroads Asia at the Diplomat for a reason. And Central Asia has a lot of these sort of ties to other places. And there's not a lot of Central Asian history that comes out, especially in Western audiences. Most of it's written in Russian and is not taught generally in schools in the United States and Europe. And so, that's how I got into Central Asia at all, was a random course that traced the Islamic heritage of Central Asia. And mm-hmm. so that, you know, it's sort of a fascinating asset that is not always brought up because it's not really understood in sense of the larger geopolitical realm. But so I found that fascinating, that the Modi camp kind of seized on this as their entry point into the region.
Yeah, and you know, Modi, who's always on social media, he was tweeting, you know, in Cyrillic while he was in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan.
Hashtag.
Anyway, yeah,
it was very. There was a lot of. I noticed, and I mentioned this to you earlier in the week, is I noticed that there was a lot of coverage from the Indian press on Central Asian things for a brief time. Central Asia doesn't really have an active press. So the reportage was a little bit more reserved and mostly mentioned leaders' remarks, sometimes with actual details and then sometimes with just a sentence that said this happened.
Right.
And that's pretty classic for Central Asian press.
Anyways, you know, I'd love to talk longer about that, but let's move the conversation a bit northwards towards a city that is rarely in the news, which is Ufa, Russia, which this week has been at the center of a variety of diplomatic activities,
yep.
Including summits for the BRICS, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the Eurasian Economic Union. And we'll probably focus our attention more on the first two that mm-hmm. I just mentioned. So Katie, can you just very quickly and succinctly just let us know, you know, what really went on in Ufa between the BRICS and the SCO summits?
Well, so due to, I guess, circumstance, Russia is hosting both the BRICS summit and the SCO summit. They have both organizations have a rotating chair, and Russia won the lottery twice this year. Of course, what that looks like from a Western perspective is Russia's got this little club of people who are fans of Russia. And so that has certainly been what has come out of Russian press in terms of Russia's gathering a group of, you know, if you're going to divide the international order into the Western camp, and then there's Russia's camp, and then this is Russia on display. And so the SCO, which originally started as a military, you know, organization in general, in terms focused on defense ties, is expanding into economic realm. They're talking about forming a development bank. I think the BRICS launched their own development bank this
mm-hmm.
year.
They did, yeah.
Recently. And so that's also, it's kind of, there's so many of these organizations in the region that I lose track of the acronyms sometimes. And so I think that it was interesting that they occurred at the same time. I don't know how much interplay there are between the two of them. I know Russia's very interested in China's One Belt, One Road and linking that to the Eurasian Economic Union in some fashion, sort of using SCO as the, I guess, facilitation for that. And so I think definitely with the SCO, the addition of India and Pakistan is one of the things to talk about. Do you think that's going to matter?
So thanks for that question. I wrote an article for The Diplomat last week in which I said, no, I don't really think it's going to matter. In fact, if you look at the SCO as a like-minded group of states, and which, you know, I think you can fairly make that argument with Russia and China leading the organization, with a smaller group of Central Asian states, also as members and a group of observers, which India and Pakistan have been for a while, along with Iran, Mongolia, and Afghanistan, and a few other countries. But India and Pakistan, I mean, if you have these two countries in the same club, in the same organization, working as while trying to work as partners, it's just not going to work out. I think I think the SCO, once it takes India and Pakistan on, is going to have a very similar experience to what India and Pakistan currently experience at the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation, SARC, where regional cooperation is pretty much inhibited by the fact that India and Pakistan can't really agree on a way to move forward. And obviously the SCO is a very different organization. You know, I don't want to overstate the SCO's role. You correctly noted that it's very much focused around security concerns, counterterrorism, and India and Pakistan both have interests in those areas. But I think, you know, as far as the SCO becoming a more important facet of the Asian geopolitical landscape, I think adding India and Pakistan will probably inhibit that. Do you have a different take on that? Or, you know, I'd love to hear your thoughts as well.
You know, largely, I think I would agree without sort of looking too deeply into it. You have a different, even though both India and Pakistan would say that terrorism is a major concern of theirs, they both look at terrorism as meaning different things. And I think that sort of inability to agree on what constitutes terrorism and who is behind terrorism is going to get in the way of making progress. And I don't know how that's going to affect the rest of the organization in terms of what it does and, you know, various drills and exchanges and things like that. So I don't know if this is necessarily a smart move for the SCO, if it just sort of morphs it into something that's similar to other things that are in the region.
Yeah, I mean, there's also two things that I'd add. I mean, from the Indian perspective, I think it would be difficult for, and, you know, I've heard Indian policymakers tell me this before in New Delhi and elsewhere, is that India couldn't let Pakistan join the SCO and not do so itself, even if India isn't interested so much, you know, in the function of the SCO as a security actor. You know, India is also interested in kind of the peripheral activities of the SCO, and, you know, like Russia has been kind of spearheading an initiative within the SCO to kind of coalesce this energy club, which is something New Delhi is very interested in. It could be a great way for New Delhi to get its get a hold on the Central Asian energy scene. And that's obviously, you know, less to do with China, which historically was a major player in the SCO. But now, you know, I mean, this is also something I wanted to mention a bit, is that the SCO, in my reading, it seems like, at least from the way China thinks about its place and its role as a leader in the international system, the SCO seems like seems to be a relic of the Hu Jintao, Wang Jiabao era of Chinese leadership. Xi Jinping, I mean, he has his Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, his Conference on Interaction and Confidence Building in Asia, SICA, the Free Trade Agreement for the Asia Pacific, the Silk Road, the One Belt, One Road, all of these initiatives that really are, you know, the new China, the kind of post-2012 China, has been, you know, focusing on these organizations as its avenues for, you know, forging leadership in Asia. And I think we wouldn't have seen many of these initiatives crop up if Xi had been satisfied with the SCO. I mean, One Belt, One Road in particular seems like it does have a lot of synergies with the SCO, but you don't really see that being framed too heavily in terms of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So I think for China itself, I mean, the importance of the SCO has kind of fallen down the foreign policy agenda for China, and now it's all these other organizations that have kind of cropped up in the Xi era that we'll see becoming more important for Beijing.
Yeah, there, you know, like I mentioned earlier, is that there's a plethora of different kinds of organizations in the region, and trying to figure out where the lines are in between them in terms of what they do and how they interact with these other things can be very difficult, especially when you can start dividing them into sort of things that Russia is more interested in, things that China is more interested in, and that division becomes sort of clear if you see China kind of pulling back from the SCO in terms of it's not the main avenue through which it wants to engage in the region.
Right. I mean, that's a very good point. I mean, Russia's got its whole alphabet soup of organizations, the CSTO, the EEU, that it's interested in, you know, spearheading. And I think the SCO still does feature pretty importantly for Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's obviously a very important consideration for India and Pakistan as well. I think, you know, the interesting thing about the SCO that I'm looking forward to seeing how India and Pakistan will affect is the regional anti-terrorist structure, RATS, which is you know, quite an acronym to refer to an anti-terrorist organization. But, you know, China initially spearheaded that, said that it would counter the three evils of terrorism, extremism, and separatism in Central Asia. And you know, China has real concerns with China's Uyghur populations and separatists in Xinjiang. And that's always been a major concern. And in fact, during Xi Jinping's time in power, those concerns haven't waned. In fact, they've gotten worse. So I think that if any part of the SCO is going to receive sustained attention from Beijing, it's going to be the counter-terrorist aspect.
Yeah, and I think the Central Asian states are going to be very much on that side in terms of that being a major focus for them.
Right. But yeah, we'll keep an eye on this issue. And, you know, India and Pakistan, they're expected to complete their membership accession by 2016, since that is a lengthy process. But it looks like the SCO will add a few new members. And then Iran is probably next on the docket, but it has a few issues to work out with the organization.
Which in itself is pretty interesting, because the SCO hasn't expanded since Uzbekistan. There was the original five, and then I think it was like 96, maybe the early 2000s when Uzbekistan joined?
Yeah, I think it was the early 2000s, but it was, yeah, it was a single expansion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is being sort of framed as the first time the organization's expanding. It's not necessarily true, but it's the first time it's expanding beyond the original members, essentially. Uzbekistan's always been a little bit behind in joining things. It likes to watch things first.
Right, right. And, you know, I should also point out that India, you know, a lot has changed in Asia over the past like 4 or 5 years, and the SCO accession process in India began under the previous government, which had a very different relationship with China, had a very different relationship with the United States. The Asian Security Order was very different. India pictured its role still in terms of a bit of a non-aligned power. So I think that what we're seeing right now is that the Modi government has really just decided to continue this process that began under the previous government and has decided that, you know, I mean, I feel like, you know, if they'd given the SCO serious thought, there might have been reason for India to you know, not join the organization. But, you know, I think now that we're here and it's happening, it's going to go forward.
So, yeah.
So let's take this conversation now to the final topic that we were going to discuss, which was a meeting at UFA, again, after the SCO summit between Narendra Modi and Nawaz Sharif. And this was an interesting meeting. It was the first meeting between these two leaders in 2015. They last met in 2014 at the SARC summit amid a very, you know, negative bilateral setting overall. India had just canceled foreign secretary level talks with Pakistan over the Pakistani ambassador meeting Hurriyat separatists in Kashmir. And this meeting that just happened in Ufa resulted in a 5-point joint statement where basically they said that they would increase the a security communication between the two sides. The national security advisors of both countries would meet to discuss terrorism. The director generals of India's border security force and Pakistan's rangers would meet, and the director generals of military operations would meet. That final point is actually a bit of an odd thing, since it happened last in late 2013. And 2013 was a really bad year on the India-Pakistan border. I think it had the most border incidents for, you know, I think about 20 years. And the DGMOs met, and that essentially didn't really change anything. So all these meetings are a lot of just window dressing for the leaders to say that they're actually making progress in the bilateral, but there's a lot of issues that keep India and Pakistan apart still. And, you know, part of the problem is also that Nawaz Sharif and the civilian leaders in Pakistan are in a very weak position. And historically, Pakistan's foreign and security policy has been held at gunpoint by the military intelligence community in the country, the ISI, the Pakistani military, and those actors have historically been a spoiler for the broader India-Pakistan situation. So I myself am not very optimistic about this meeting or its implications for the broader picture between New Delhi and Islamabad. I don't know, Katie, do you have a different take on that, or do you want to highlight something?
I mean, as far as India and Pakistan is concerned, I think pessimism is the general default. Things, you know, they ebb and flow. Sometimes things get better, sometimes things get a little bit worse, but there isn't general overall progress that you see. I think it'll be interesting to keep an eye on Afghanistan and its role that it plays between the two. It's not geographically between the two, but it's definitely a little bit of a football there. And so Afghanistan's warming up. The Afghan administration's a little bit warmer towards Pakistan than the previous administration has been. There were talks in Islamabad between representatives of the Afghan government and the Taliban this past week.
Right.
And so that was interesting for the location, even if the only thing they agreed on was to talk more about things. That is some level of progress. And I wonder if that might factor into helping the India-Pakistan relationship, or be part of the reason to have a little bit of hope about the meeting between Modi and Sharif. But I think you're largely correct to stick with pessimism, which is sad to say.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'd love to be proven wrong, but
there's a lot of things I'd love to be proven wrong on, and that's definitely one of them.
Right. It's actually interesting, the Afghan thing, I'll just point out. I was looking at the photo shoot after the SCO summit, and I noticed that Ghani was standing between Sharif and Modi, which I thought was an interesting bit of symbolism, since there was that perpetual tug of war.
He was one of the only people smiling in that picture.
Yeah, that's true. He had a lot of people standing around him who'd love to help his country out. So, you know, I'd be smiling if I was Ghani. But Ghani, you know, he's an interesting character, a bit of an optimist about Pakistan's role, talks with the Taliban. But we can save that for a different podcast, because I think that merits another 30 minutes of discussion solidly. Anyways, Katie, thanks a lot for coming on today. I really enjoyed this discussion.
Thank you very much for having me. I've been around at The Diplomat for a little bit now. I couldn't continue to say no.
Exactly. Yeah. And hopefully you'll be a regular fixture on these podcasts. And I'm hoping you do a lot more on Central Asia. It's a fascinating region. And like I said, Modi is currently in Turkmenistan. He'll go to Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. And if you're interested in finding out what he's going to accomplish there, including if the TAPI pipeline comes up, just keep an idea. Just keep your eye on our Crossroads Asia blog. And Katie will have the latest for you. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you.